I've been charged with moderating the speakers, and I'm not sure that I'm able to do that. However, I will at least introduce them. The speakers for today's panel all participated in a delegation to Colombia from February 14th to 21st of this year that was organized by the Washington Office on Latin America. The purpose of the trip was threefold. First, to evaluate the effects of the internal armed conflict on Colombian civil society and the consolidation of democratic institutions there. Secondly, to examine civil society initiatives that could contribute to the resolution of the conflict. And lastly, to explore ways that the international community might be more supportive of peace efforts in Colombia. Our delegation met with a vast range of people, including U.S. government officials, in particular the U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson and other embassy officials, national, regional, and local Colombian government officials, Colombian military authorities, members of the judicial branch, including the 9 members of the Constitutional Court and members of the Office of the Public Ombudsman in various places throughout the region, educators and scholars at local schools and institutes of higher education, leaders of the Catholic and Protestant communities there, labor union leaders, human rights organizations, and representatives of popular sectors and development organizations. In addition to the capital city of Bogota, we traveled to 3 distinct regions, and I'm going to ask Tina to use her laser pointer there as I describe the 3 regions that we went to give you a sense of the amount of territory we covered. And I should just add that we traveled by chartered plane and were accompanied by armed guards for a good portion of the trip. The one area that we tried to get through that we were planning to drive through, there was a roadblock put up by the guerrilla group, the FARC, and we were unable to get into that zone. The first area was Barranca Bermeja in the province of Santander in what is known as the Middle Magdalena region. It's strategically located in the center of Colombia, accessible to the Atlantic Ocean via the Magdalena River, which is Colombia's 965-mile equivalent of the Mississippi River, which also provides an easy drug transit route to different regions of the country. Barranca Bermeja is a town of some 300,000 people, more than 80% of whom were displaced from other parts of Colombia. The region also includes wide expanses of jungle and mountains, which are increasingly used for the planting of illegal crops. Barranca Bermeja is the locale of the largest oil refinery in the country and supplies about 75% of Colombia's fuel. It's also close to various mining areas, gold and copper especially. Its location and industry offer many opportunities for armed actors to profit from extortion, kidnappings, and the theft of gas, which helps to finance the war. The second region we went to was Popayan in Colombia's southwestern province of Cauca. Popayan is one of Colombia's oldest cities and the former center of gold mining and colonial riches, as well as the capital of the province. Cauca is home to the largest concentration of indigenous and Afro-Colombian populations, which constitute about a third of the national population. It is also one of the poorest regions of the country, with about 300,000 indigenous people organized into 115 cabildos, many of which belong to the Indigenous Regional Council of Cauca. This is a zone that is about 65% rural. And as I mentioned, because of a FARC road blockade between Cali and Popayan, we were unable to visit La Maria, a resident-designated peace zone established in 1999 on indigenous lands through negotiations between the community and the armed guerrilla and paramilitary actors. The third region that we visited was Sincelejo. This is the capital and the largest city of the province of Sucre. Sincelejo is located in one of 2 zones of rehabilitation and consolidation set up in September 2002 by the Uribe government. These 2 rehabilitation zones include 27 municipalities containing over 1 million people in the departments of Bolívar, Sucre, and Arauca. Sincelejo's strategic location in the middle of the Maria Mountains has made it a magnet for displaced people from the nearby mountain neighborhoods. About 3 years ago, the paramilitaries began moving from Antioquia and Cordoba into the departments of Sucre and Bolívar, and this has led to battles over land that have caught the civilian population in the middle. They're frequently either killed or displaced. A few general observations. U.S. involvement in Colombia has been steadily expanding in scope and in dollars. Last year, despite the valiant leadership of Congressman Jim McGovern and others, the U.S. Congress authorized the use of lethal U.S. assistance, previously limited to counter-narcotics efforts, for the purpose of counterinsurgency efforts in Colombia. Colombia has been the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel and Egypt. From 1999 to 2002, the United States gave Colombia more than $2 billion in aid, with 83% of that amount going to Colombia's military and police. President Bush's requests for an additional $1 billion has requested an additional $1 billion for the next 2 years and has supplemented that request with an emergency appropriation earlier this month of a further $104 million, again mostly in military aid to Colombia. While the attention of the U.S. public has been focused elsewhere, U.S. engagement in Colombia has been steadily growing, as has the armed conflict within that country and increasingly beyond that country's borders. The armed conflict in Colombia is not a conflict that can be readily understood in simplistic terms. Our trips to the countryside underscored the importance of understanding regional variations and taking care to differentiate the nature and origins of the many different kinds of violence being committed by multiple actors. A peace process underway for 3 years under former President Pastrana failed last year, and a war-weary public ushered in President Álvaro Uribe with a mandate to address the grave security concerns of the country. Yet the security for much of the civilian population has deteriorated. Political space for legitimate dissent and the defense of basic human rights is being undermined, and dire human needs are not being met. Since President Uribe came to power last year, the armed conflict has intensified both in brutality and scope, as the armed forces, the guerrillas, and the paramilitaries all appear to be stronger than ever. Our meetings throughout the country confirmed that the inadvertent victims of President Álvaro Uribe's security policies and of the powerful guerrilla and paramilitary groups as well are largely unarmed civilians, including those who are promoting political dialogue or seeking more equitable development policies. To discuss these and other issues investigated our trip, we have joining us several members of the delegation. They will appear in the following order: Congressman Jim McGovern in the center, then Charlie Curry, president of the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities, on my left. In the middle, Kim Stanton, deputy director and director of studies at the Washington Office on Latin America, and finally Eric Olson on the far end, advocacy director for the Americas for Amnesty International. I'd also like to acknowledge here with us Cindy Buell, legislative director for Congressman McGovern, Jason Hagan, associate on Columbia for WOLA, and Tina Hodges, program associate for the Andes for WOLA. They also accompanied us on the trip. They're not formally part of the panel, but they will be available for questions should you have questions for them at the end as well. I've asked each participant to give a brief presentation of some 8 minutes in order to allow some time for discussion afterwards. As their bios are available in a handout outside the door, I will not go into lengthy introductions of each one. I would just like to say that it is a particular honor for me to be able to welcome Congressman McGovern here today. I had the rewarding experience of working with him in the 1980s on issues relating to Latin America when he was a lowly but powerful aide to Congressman Joe Moakley, and I'm glad to have been able to accompany him and this delegation to Colombia. Thank you, Congressman McGovern.
That's when I had power, when I was an aide, Joe Moakley. Well, first of all, let me thank the U.S. Institute for Peace for hosting this panel presentation, and I particularly want to thank Jeanne Bouvier, who is an invaluable member of our delegation and whose prodigious note-taking has ensured that we have a valuable and important record of our trip. I also want to join in thanking Kim Stanton and Jason Hagan and Tina Hodges of the Washington Office on Latin America, who organized the trip to Colombia and took me to places and introduced me to people that the average member of Congress never has an opportunity to visit or to meet with such people. Let me also begin by simply saying that Colombia is an important foreign policy issue that deserves greater debate, and I want to thank USIP for this opportunity to discuss it in more detail. My initial remarks will be fairly brief, and I will, so we can make sure everybody gets a chance to speak, and then we can take some questions. Let me just preface my remarks by saying at the outset that I have the utmost respect for our U.S. Ambassador to Colombia, Ann Patterson, and our USAID Mission Director, Ken Ellis. I've worked with them for many years when they were based in El Salvador, and I've appreciated our interactions on Columbia. I think they both represent the very best of Korea Foreign Service officers that we have as part of our government. I want to also say that this was my second trip to Colombia, and I was 2 years ago, and much has changed during these last 2 years, and I regret to say that, in my opinion, much has changed, not for the better, but in fact, things, in my opinion, have deteriorated. Formal negotiations between the government and the largest guerrilla organization, the FARC, collapsed, and there is no indication of them resuming. The war has expanded to all areas of the country. Violence and repression by paramilitary and guerrilla forces against the civilian population have escalated significantly. Human rights crimes and abuses by official government, military, and security forces are on the increase. There is no credible prosecution of high military and government officials accused or charged with human rights crimes, especially of those charged with collaborating with paramilitary groups. The ability of civil society, especially human rights groups, labor unions, opposition politicians, to express criticism of official government policy or advocate for alternatives has greatly decreased. Everywhere we went, individuals and groups expressed concern about shutting down of political space. From peasant communities to the magistrates who sit on Colombia's constitutional court, this was a universal concern that we heard everywhere. I was particularly struck by what passes for security in Colombia outside of the major cities. I visited areas under the effective control of the paramilitaries and where five Colombian military battalions are based in addition to official police. Yet criminal gangs were openly robbing and selling gasoline on nearly every corner. And human rights defenders and labor leaders were daily threatened. In fact, the police followed us to our meeting with local human rights, with the local human rights ombudsman, interrupted our meeting and wanted our names and the reasons why we were meeting. I mean, they had time to interrogate us, but they didn't seem to have time to deal with the illegal groups that were engaged in the black market. In another town located in one of the two government-designated zones of rehabilitation, we met with military officers who keep track of transgressions committed by the guerrillas, but not by the paramilitaries, who do not engage the guerrillas, but respond only after the fact, but who remain strongly barracked in towns, keeping watch on the civilian population. So the guerrillas run free in the mountains, the paramilitaries control the coastal and inland plains, and the Colombian military sit in the towns as more and more displaced people arrive, fleeing the violence in the countryside. Now, over the past 2 years, the U.S. role in Colombia has also changed markedly, as Jenny pointed out. The U.S. has more troops and civilian contractors on the ground in Colombia than ever before. Some are directly involved in training and advising the counterinsurgency war, and some Americans have now been killed and captured in this war. Now, during our recent trip, I was particularly moved by the efforts of NGOs, the churches, and others to address the root causes of poverty and injustice at the local community level, often at great risk to themselves and at great risk to their families. We saw communities organizing to build schools, feed children, provide employment, and create a variety of economic alternatives to illegal drug crops. They are undertaking these measures because the Colombian government either will not, does not, and, or cannot do it. Many of these efforts are funded by the Europeans, the United Nations, and in some cases by USAID. The Colombian government basically told our delegation that if we, meaning Congress, want to see development in Colombia, then it is our responsibility and the responsibility of the international community to fund it. Their government will not do it. However, President Uribe travels all around the country making promises to provide development resources, but unfortunately, he doesn't seem to be able to deliver on those promises. We also saw and heard of grassroots efforts, again, mainly by the churches and religious-based NGOs, to create a dialogue between the community and the dominant armed actors in their area in order to decrease the level of violence and conflict threatening the community. These efforts are being carried out with paramilitary forces and with various guerrilla groups. They are a lesson in communities demanding some level of accountability of the armed actors and the official armed forces that occupy their regions and declare themselves as the ones, quote, in control. These are very, very courageous actions. They might also become, over time, the basis of confidence building that could lead to region-wide or even country-wide ceasefires or negotiations. Now, I know that other panelists are going to touch on these issues in much more depth, but let me just say a few more words in conclusion. Right now, everybody is focused on Iraq or on the Middle East, and a few people still remember a place called Afghanistan. But in the meantime, we are also very, very much involved in Colombia. It is very frustrating to me that here in the United States, we approve and pursue major foreign policy initiatives with very little debate, discussion, or thoughtful review. Now, I believe that Iraq was a case in point. It seemed to me that every parliament in the world was debating the Iraq situation, yet the United States Congress had one day of debate last October, and that was that. Now, I'm not saying the outcome would have been different, and I'm not trying to make a statement on whether we should be for or against U.S. military action in Iraq, but it is a little bit puzzling to me that other capitals in the world were debating this when we in the Congress were not. And I think that there's a tendency, and I'm very concerned about this, that the more serious and potentially controversial a policy might be, the greater the level of silence by the United States Congress. Now, in Colombia, we are moving ahead in support of a counterinsurgency strategy to address militarily a 40-year-old civil war with little to no debate. And the escalation of our military involvement is often slipped into supplemental appropriation bills that are focused primarily on other key strategic objectives. Another $100 million for Colombia was snuck into the wartime supplemental for Iraq. And again, with no discussion leading up to the insertion of that additional money. I would even argue with you that a majority of my colleagues in Congress probably don't appreciate that a little over a year ago, they approved a major shift in U.S. policy toward Colombia. They allowed for there to be language that would allow the United States to not only be involved in the counter-narcotics efforts in Colombia, but also to be involved in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency efforts in Colombia. Now, I think that again, I have high respect for all of my colleagues in both the House and the Senate, but I think that a good number of them haven't a clue of what we're doing in Colombia or to the extent of our involvement. Now, I want to also just say here that I do believe that we should be involved in Colombia. And we should not and we must not walk away from Colombia. I think there is a role for the United States to play. But the questions that I hear from my colleagues, which kind of frustrate me when I question our current policy, is they usually respond by saying, yeah, but what's the alternative? Isn't this better than nothing? Well, first, let me say that Colombia is a very complicated place. Anybody who has visited Colombia, anybody who has been to a briefing on Colombia, can appreciate the fact that Colombia is an incredibly complicated place. And the solutions to Colombia's difficulties are also very complicated. And I will argue that current U.S. policy, which is, in my opinion, further militarizing this conflict, is simplistic and is wrong-headed. It is not achieving, I think, the goals that I think all of us want for Colombia, which is an end to the violence and a better life for the majority of people who live in Colombia. And I think there are several things that we must do other than simply boost military aid. First, we must deal with the issue of impunity. At USIP, you must hear this all the time for any number of countries. So you know how critical this is to establishing the rule of law and creating some sense of confidence in the judicial system and the hope that serious crimes, human rights crimes, will be punished. Right now, under the current Attorney General in Colombia, Colombia is going in the opposite direction. And the Uribe government is slashing the budgets of the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office and the Human Rights Unit inside the Ministry of Justice. President Uribe is also proposing laws that would grant him the ability to stack the deck in Congress with politicians loyal to him and to his agenda. Now, none of these actions, in my opinion, contribute to a climate where people can believe that impunity will end and justice will prevail. Second, you have to be able to feed your people and address their most basic needs. Colombia is a moderately wealthy country. It is a medium-income developing country, but it has 67% poverty. Think about to have those kinds of numbers. And yet, President Bush's budget for Colombia actually proposes less money for development assistance for Colombia in FY04 than in FY05. It seems to be pushing our policy in the wrong direction. The FARC and the paramilitaries are ruthless, awful, violent terrorist groups, no doubt about it. Yet, everywhere we went, we heard that recruits, especially young people, join these groups, not out of any sense of ideology, but because they can get fed and they get a salary. Now, if we're going to deal effectively with these armed actors, dry up their ability to get recruits, then we must deal far more effectively with injustice and poverty in Colombia, much more effectively than we are doing right now. And finally, one more thing on the issue of impunity and ending the conflict in Colombia. When guerrilla forces decide to demobilize, and I hope that we can get to that point soon, there must be genuine guarantees that they won't be murdered for having done so. The history of Colombia is quite clear on this point. Over the past two decades, those forces that have chosen to turn in their guns and attempted to reintegrate into society have been killed, period. I mean, that is just a fact. We met with a young woman, a former guerrilla fighter with the EPL, who demobilized 5 years ago with 1,500 of her comrades. Of that group, only 200 are still alive. The rest have been murdered. Now, these are just a few of the issues that I believe must be taken more seriously and more seriously debated in Congress if we are going to have any hope that U.S. policy will genuinely contribute to an end to the conflict in that war-torn country. And at this point, I will stop and turn it over to my other colleagues here. Thank you very much. I appreciate that's a hard act to follow. One of the great privileges of being on this trip was to be in the presence of Jim McGovern for about a week and experience again his incredible integrity, candor, and courage that has been the hallmark of his career in Congress. And that was a great privilege to be with you today. It was also a great opportunity to experience the good work of WOLA in organizing a trip. I had the privilege of going down to Cuba with Congressman McGovern and Congressman Mokley and all the folks at WOLA. And if you want to go on a trip, go with WOLA. They know how to do it. This was my first trip to Colombia, so I hardly qualify as any sort of an expert. But I'll try to imitate Congressman McGovern's candor and take advantage of the preparation and guidance of my good friends at WOLA. Very briefly, I want to describe something of what we learned about the role of the churches and church men and women in Colombia today. By way of background, any discussion of the church in Latin America must recognize the demographics and the influence of liberation theology. The demographics. The region continues to be predominantly Catholic, as you know, but with increasing importance of the Protestant churches, or as they say, the evangelical churches. In Colombia, Protestants make up 14% of the population, and only about 4% of the evangelicals are mainstream Protestants, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Mennonites, etc. And we were privileged to meet with Protestant leaders from the Presbyterian, Lutheran, and Mennonite churches. Catholics and Protestants work together in a small ecumenical network, but there's still scars remaining from the situation before the constitutional reforms of 1991, when Protestants were not only not recognized, but their religious rights and freedoms were not guaranteed. That's one of my experiences over the years, that the best way to get things done is to do it ecumenically, and that was difficult to do in Latin America until relatively recently. Here at home, the U.S. National Council of Churches has passed a strong resolution on Colombia, as have the Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, United Church of Christ, the Mennonites, and Episcopals. And we were fortunate to have, as part of our delegation, the president-elect of the National Council of Churches, Bishop Tom Hoyt, who kept this Jesuit, this particular Jesuit, in line throughout the trip. The U.S. Conference of Bishops have also issued a statement calling for a genuine balance between assisting security forces and providing the kind of aid that directly gets to the root causes of the conflict. In general, the church's focus has been on the displaced persons, the humanitarian crisis, peace building, and also attacks on the churches. Catholics and Protestants alike have been under attack by both guerrillas and paramilitaries. Church leaders who have spoken out in favor of peace and human rights, or who protested abuses, have been targeted, and many have been assassinated. Recently, the Archbishop of Cali, Bishop Duarte Cancino, who frequently spoke out against corruption, was killed. And according to the Human Rights Watch World Report for 2003, in the first 11 months of 2002, 11 priests, 1 nun, and 18 Protestant pastors were killed. More church leaders killed than in any other comparable period in the country's recent history. Churches and church leaders are often attacked simply because they won't take sides. A brief word about liberation theology. No discussion of the church in Latin America can be complete without some mention of this. Prior to 1960, the church tended to counsel the poor to accept their suffering with patience and hope for salvation. The church was very much part of the status quo, and many people would say very much part of the problem. In 1960, a young Uruguayan Jesuit, Jean Luis Segundo, suggested a different approach, engaging directly the massive human suffering and injustice in Latin America. The Second Vatican Council in the early 60s emphasized the church's involvement in the concerns of humankind. And in 1968, Pope Paul VI went to Medellin, Colombia, and urged the Latin American bishops to apply Vatican II to their reality. And in a Magna Carta for today's persecuted, socially committed church, the bishops gathered at Medellin committed themselves to a preferential option for the poor. So that after Medellin in 1968, priests and nuns and religious leaders began to preach to the poor that their hunger, poverty, and powerlessness were not the will of God, but the result of injustice. They were encouraged to liberate themselves and find God in the midst of their struggle. Perhaps Archbishop Romero in El Salvador is the best-known spokesperson for this message. Today in Colombia and elsewhere, many church leaders have backed away from the most ambitious forms of liberation theology. But there remain church leaders with a strong commitment to link action on behalf of justice with their faith in the gospel. We spoke with many of these on our trip. The basic thrust of liberation theology is also alive in the grassroots of the churches, so that church leaders and grassroots Christians together are deeply engaged in the social struggle that Congressman McGovern spoke of. Against this background, let me briefly describe a few of our experiences. First, the Middle Magdalena Program for Development and Peace. This is a communal effort to build up a society in the midst of conflict in northern Colombia, an excellent example of community helping itself. There are about 800,000 inhabitants in the area where both paramilitaries and guerrillas are active. 2,000 people have been killed in this region. The program is directed by a Jesuit, Father DeRue, and sponsored by the Diocese of Barranca Bermeja and by the Center for the Investigation of Popular Education, a Jesuit social research center in Bogota. We learned of educational programs, projects of sustainable human and economic development, for example, trying to end the cocoa production by growing alternatives. It was a great experience to witness the courage of these folks who essentially told the paramilitaries and the guerrillas, stay away, we can do it on our own. And they've done that by paying a price. In 6 years of existence, 4 members of the team have been kidnapped, 2 of them Jesuits, all of them have been freed, but 9 members of the community have been killed by the paramilitaries. As a Jesuit, I was also happy to learn that other initiatives being taken by Jesuits and their co-workers. The Program for Peace, the Jesuit Refugee Service, addressing the needs of nearly 2.5 million people displaced since 1985. In Colombia, the displaced are the poorest of the poor, and 70% of them are under 18. Jesuits also run a Center for Investigation in Popular Education, CINEP. Today, there are 35 researchers trying to help find solutions and support collaborative efforts. In Barranca Bermeja, we met with Bishop Jaime Prieto, who echoed a theme we heard from many others in various ways. Peace is key, but it has to include reconciliation, true reconciliation, based on truth and justice. To get to peace, we need to get to truth. Colombia also needs to deal with the anger and hatred that is so strong. The refrain we've heard before in South Africa, El Salvador, Guatemala, and elsewhere. The bishop spoke of the delicate role of church leaders in Colombia today. He described that role as being an autonomous facilitator, as opposed to an observer or a mediator. When church leaders denounce some actions, they not only can lose their autonomy, but they can also be blamed for the deaths that may well follow. Church leaders have to be discerning because they're often the only protection the defenseless poor have. They have to combine announcement and denouncement, the bishop said, making sure the two always go together. I think some of us were debating just what that meant. The Catholic bishops have spoken out in the defense and promotion of human rights and on the importance of integrated development for the country. And we met with Monsignor Hector Fabio, the director of the National Secretariat of Social Ministries for the Colombian Catholic Bishops Conference. The secretariat directs its effort to preparing for democracy, whenever that will come, human rights and peace, working with the displaced, social development. Monsignor Fabio noted that the killing of priests and religious has hurt the work of base communities, and that people in social ministries are now the target of many threats. There's an urgent need for space and security, as the congressman mentioned, but a danger that security is being interpreted in too narrow perspective. We met with the poor community of displaced persons in Sincelejo. It was a rather traumatic experience, it was a very moving experience to see so many traumatized children in front of us, many of whom had seen their mothers or fathers killed. I've never seen such a collection of students with children, so many of them traumatized. Normally, you see a group of 200 or 300 kids, and they're all jumping up and laughing. A lot of these kids did not have anything to laugh about. The school is run there by Justa Paz, the Peace and Justice Agency of the Colombian Mennonite Church. The school provides counseling as well as education for children, many of whom have been traumatized. Over lunch, we spoke with the young woman that Congressman McGovern spoke of, Alexandrina, a former guerrilla who now works as a counselor for these children. We had a 10-year-old girl stand up and plead with us to help keep her school open because it was threatened to be closed. What about the future? There's an obvious need to overcome a legacy of violence in order to rebuild civil society on relationships of trust rather than coercion. This can best and perhaps only be achieved in a nonviolent way. The situation we saw is obviously very complex. The best source of hope I would see is a number of incredibly courageous people we met with. These people risk their lives every day to bring peace and justice to their country. Many of the groups we met with, I couldn't help but think how many of them will be alive a year from now. But they continue on great courage. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want, on behalf of WOLA, just to say thank you again to the U.S. Institute for Peace for co-sponsoring this event. And I also want to acknowledge on behalf of our delegation the collaboration and support that we received from the Colombian Embassy here in Washington and the U.S. Embassy in Colombia, both of which facilitated our visit, facilitated visas, and made it possible for us to maneuver through the requirements for foreign travel in Colombia. So some of our friends from the Colombian Embassy are here today, and I just want to say publicly thank you for the support that you gave us. I want to focus very quickly on two issues, just talk a little bit more in detail about what we mean when we say that we found a closing of political space in Colombia, and say a little more about the civil society efforts to find ways forward, which were very inspiring for all of us. WOLA has long been on record that U.S. counter-narcotics policy in Latin America, in our view, is counterproductive and ineffective on its own terms and dangerous for democracy and human rights. From the beginning of the debate about Plan Colombia, we were concerned in particular about this policy in the context of a country with a 40-year-old civil war. We were concerned that because of the armed conflict, the temptation to slide from counter-narcotics into counterinsurgency would be great, and that the risks to Colombia's fragile democracy, that the risk was that the democracy would be further weakened, not strengthened, as a result. In the aftermath of September 11th, we have seen what my colleagues have already referred to, the shift to expanded authority and to using counter-narcotics assistance for counter-terrorism purposes, which in Colombia is essentially counter-insurgency. And we want to, I think it's important to point out that President Uribe has very self-consciously adopted the language of counterterrorism. His democratic security policies, which include the declaring of a state of emergency, placing regions of the country under military control, creating an informants network, and seeking to give judicial police powers to the military, are counterinsurgency tactics. These are not the kind of measures that come to mind when we think collectively about constructing peace or deepening democracy. And so, in fact, even recognizing that, we were all struck by, during our visit in February, by how much the space for legal democratic activities in Colombia has shrunk in recent months. And I just want to say a couple of things about what it means to say that and why it's important. We met with, as people have already said, human rights defenders and union activists and religious leaders and local and regional political officials, state officials, in every city that we visited. We had a major meeting of human rights defenders and union activists in Bogota. We had smaller meetings in Barranca with organizations many of you will recognize, the OFP, the CREOS, and key unions that have been very much in the headlines for the attacks that they have endured. We heard someone describe to us the ombudsman of Barranca as, quote unquote, waging what life remains for him in his work to defend human rights. What's at issue here is that human rights and union activists continue to be threatened and attacked and at risk of death, in spite of the efforts to increase security since last August. As a result of the emergency measures that were promulgated last fall, we've seen an indiscriminate use of force, violations of due process, and increases in arbitrary arrests and detentions, violations to right to freedom of movement, including frequent raids of legal organizations, which in fact were not based on credible evidence of criminal activity and did not lead to any kind of prosecution. Nothing was found. Some of these measures were declared unconstitutional in November of 2002, but we were told by many people in all the places that we visited that ruling didn't necessarily end some of these practices. And we would, I think, direct your attention to recent reports by the State Department and by the UN High Commissioner's Office that document some of these concerns. There's another practice which has been growing in the last few months, which is very worrisome, and it is the rather startling tendency on the part of leading government officials to disparage legal democratic activities or legal people engaged in dissent, engaged in trying to develop alternative policies, criticizing government policies, and the tendency to implicitly or explicitly link these activities to subversion or terrorism. Those of you who read the Colombian press will find an article in today's El Tiempo about this issue. I won't go here into specific cases, but we can in questions if you want. What I would like to just emphasize is why do people worry so much if an official says, you know, in an offhand comment, or what appears to be an offhand comment, that X NGO is, well, you know, probably a front for the guerrilla. The reason there's such concern about this is because that kind of what's called guerrillamiento in Spanish is linked to inappropriate use of military intelligence archives in Colombia, information in archives which is incorrect and in some cases false, somehow ends up getting leaked to illegal armed actors, and people become very much physical targets as a result of these kinds of alleged linkages with terrorist or guerrilla groups. So it's not just about the words, it's about what those words signal for to certain kinds of actors which are not yet under control in Colombia. We also found great concern about many proposed political reforms that the government is encouraging. These are concerns which are both substantive in the sense that some of the reforms seemed designed to roll back advances that were included in the 1991 Constitution, judicial sector reforms that would limit the oversight of the Constitutional Court over states of emergency after Colombia has a long history of actually living under states of emergency, that would restrict the use of legal challenges and certain kinds of rights. These are things which people feel both that they're being sort of singled out as doing inappropriate or anti-patriotic or illegal activity on the one hand, and on the other hand, institutionally, there are efforts underway to further limit the space in which they would be able to operate. And again, we can go into more detail if there's time during questions. So I think the question that we came away with is a little bit why are these folks, why are democratic actors, human rights organizations, unions, religious leaders, the target of any kind of investigation or pursuit in Colombia, which is a country which has real enemies on the ground? There really are terrorist groups in Colombia. Human rights defenders and union leaders aren't terrorists, and people who oppose the government per se or oppose government policies aren't terrorists. So we came away even more convinced of the importance of supporting that critical democratic opposition, which is what makes democracy work anywhere in the world, including in our own country here. The really good news from our visit is that Colombian civil society is incredible. People do put their lives on the line every day, as Charlie just said, and churches and non-governmental groups and local and regional authorities have really taken the lead in designing and implementing comprehensive development programs that merit much greater support within Colombia and internationally. We learned about three such efforts. We've already talked a little bit about the program on development and peace in the Middle Magdalen River Valley. We also, in Popayan with Governor Flora Tunubola, heard very much about the Plan Alterno, the alternative plan that six governors from southwestern Colombia have been working on since they came into office in 2000. And we learned about the mayor's development plan in the Montes de Maria region, which is in the consolidation zone around Sincelejo. I want to highlight just a couple of things about what these programs have in common. They are about an integrated approach to sustainable development. They incorporate attention to human rights and cultural issues and local communities, as well as to the issues of economic alternatives. They are participatory and they are multi-sectoral. In Barranca Bermeja, in the projects that we saw with the PDPM program, there is involvement by Ecopetrol, the state oil corporation. There is involvement by churches, by human rights groups, by local community organizations, belatedly by local authorities after they realized that it was kind of going somewhere, by universities. The same in Popayan. These are projects which really are consensus building and which bring together many different actors. They are also projects which emphasize basic needs. They include attention to education and health and housing and infrastructure, as well as productive projects and technical assistance. And they include an element of strengthening institutions and organizations, of capacity building for those groups that are participating in them. They have many obstacles in common. They are, as we've said already, the focus of threats and attacks. The main obstacle is basically a shortage of funding. These are programs which have been presented to the Colombian government. They were presented to Mr. Pastrana's government. The governors, in particular, tried very hard to get central government support for these efforts during the last 2 years. But the major support comes from the international community. UNDP has actually just spent a little bit of money to foster a new network called Red Pro de Paz, which is a network of 15 of these programs that basically has brought them all together. The Justa Paz program that Charlie mentioned is one of these. The CRIC Plan de Vida, which is part of the Alternative Plan in the Southwest, is another one. There are 15 of these programs with a presence in 28 provinces and more than 300 municipalities in Colombia. It's true that there's a risk that civil society ends up, through these projects, displacing the state, because they are providing services that theoretically or ideally the state should provide. But in the interim, in the context in which really the Colombian government is now focused on investing almost entirely only on the military side and not investing on the democratic side of its democratic security policy, these are the programs that offer a real alternative for moving forward. They've demonstrated that their activities can generate a degree of security at the local level that is otherwise has otherwise evaded the central government. And we really think that a combination of supporting the democratic actors who should not be the target of investigations and supporting alternative development programs like these that offer a methodology that are organizing amongst themselves and already extending their model throughout the country would provide two core elements of a different approach with a much more likely possibility of addressing the underlying causes of Colombia's longstanding conflict. Thank you.
I'll try to be exceedingly brief because I don't want to eat into our question and answer time. I want to thank USIP as well for setting this up, and especially Ginny Bouvier for inviting me to be on this panel. Ginny and I are members of an unknown, unpowerful association for which I am immensely proud. We're former WOLA employees, and it was a great pleasure to be with WOLA on this delegation, and I would agree with what Charlie said. If you have to travel to complex and difficult places in Latin America, try to go on a WOLA trip. Ginny asked me to talk about labor rights. It was one of the focus issues on our trip. There were actually three union representatives on our trip, none of which could be here today, so I agreed to pinch hit. Two of them were from the Service Employees International Union, one an international vice president of the union. And the third was Steve Beckman from the United Auto Workers, and I'm sure they would have done a much better job than I'm about to do to talk about labor rights in Colombia. Nevertheless, I wanted to just briefly make three points, possible conclusions that I drew from our trip related to labor rights. First, maybe obvious from what you've already heard, but trade unionists continue to be victims of grave human rights violations, including assassinations, threats, attacks, and disappearances. Most of those violations have gone on public, unpunished, and hence the issue of impunity. This was confirmed most recently in the State Department's own human rights report for 2002, where they said labor union activists continue to be victims of high levels of violence. Just to give you a flavor for that, according to the CUT, the largest federation, the Central Unitaria de Trabajadores, the largest federation of unions in Colombia, they estimate that nearly 200 unionists were killed in 2002, over 20 suffered assaults, and more than 30 were kidnapped or disappeared during that time period. And the numbers for 2001 are roughly about the same. The sectors most affected by this violence are the education sector, teachers unions, healthcare workers, agriculture workers, and two sectors that we met with, petroleum workers and food worker unions. And we in all our visits in all of the regions of Colombia that we were, with the exception of Sincelejo, met with union workers who confirmed over and over again the fact that they are the targets of very serious violence. The second conclusion is, again, this issue of political space closing down. This isn't necessarily a new phenomenon, but it's certainly been continued and maybe emphasized even more under the current administration in Colombia. Public officials have sought to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the trade union movement by making disparaging public statements that associate union members with armed movements, or in other cases they pursued legal cases against union leaders, accusing them for association with terrorist organizations or armed opposition. The clearest case of this that we saw on our trip, and this isn't the only one, was in Barranca Bermeja, where we met with the Unión Sindical Obrera, which is the petroleum workers' union. Many of the leaders past and present of the union are under threat. As you enter into their entryway, there's a dozen or so framed pictures of union leaders that have been killed over the years. They've certainly been in a combative relationship, but now as well, much of the union leadership is being threatened with legal action. We met with the former head of the union, Hernando Hernandez, who is technically under house arrest. He opted to have his house arrest, serve his house arrest in the union headquarters. So we met with him there in his house arrest. He is being accused not of some corruption or unsavory labor activity, but of rebellion. And of association with the ELN, which is the armed group most active in that area. Let's see. According to the UN in their latest report, deprecating statements, as they call them, threats and attacks against union members have not only put the lives of union members in danger, but have stigmatized legitimate union activity and contributed to a climate of intolerance, making legitimate union activity in effect very difficult. Third and finally, evidence suggests that most of the violent attacks against unions can be attributed to paramilitary groups. This is the conclusion of the United Nations office in Colombia. This is the conclusion of Amnesty International, and it's the conclusion of the State Department, which said in its 2002 report, again, paramilitaries continue to commit numerous unlawful and political killings, particularly of labor leaders, often kidnapping and torturing suspected guerrilla sympathizers prior to executing them. We saw an example of this when we visited with the food workers from Sinaltranal. We were meeting particularly with workers with the Coca-Cola bottling company, who have accused the company of using paramilitary members, soldiers, as security guards, as thugs to break up the union and in effect to kill members of the union. And those leaders of that union themselves are under severe threat. When we came to their offices, there were five armed guards with automatic weapons in front, and it was truly a disturbing, meeting to just see the kind of pressure that they're under as they confront these paramilitary forces. So I'll leave it at that, just in conclusion to say that in addition to the human rights NGOs, the traditional human rights groups that Kim mentioned, was confirmed to us that labor union leaders themselves were targeted by violence and that their own legitimate activities as unions were certainly being undermined as a result of this. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to put in a plug for Colombian coffee. We were up at 5:30 or 6 every morning, and we worked until about midnight every night. And you can see that we met with quite a number of people, and it would not have been possible without the coffee. I'd just like to make a few comments before I open it to questions rather than monopolize the floor. We have about 15 minutes left, and I really want to thank the panelists for their succinct presentations and for their ability to bring in some of the human element of the various people that we met with and really compliment one another in your presentations. I think we leave with a feeling of some hope despite a very dismal situation in many aspects. Although the national peace process has stagnated, there are signs at the local level that civil society is searching for ways to encourage peace. Development is taking place, although at great risk and often without sufficient support within zones of conflict. Local initiatives abound, many of which should be worth supporting. That said, security in Colombia must be viewed in broader terms, in terms of a security that includes the guarantees of fundamental rights and the fulfillment of basic needs, as well as an integrated approach to sustainable development. The impact of the conflict on civil society leaves tremendous work to be done in terms of humanitarian assistance. I think many of the speakers today have mentioned the closing down of political space, and I'd just like to add that we did meet, and some of us met in meetings off to the side, with members of universities in Colombia, and they too were concerned about the shrinking of intellectual space. They were concerned that problems in Colombia were, that it was becoming more and more difficult to discuss problems in Colombia and alternative solutions beyond the military solution to the conflict in Colombia within the universities and within the academic setting. We were told that drugs, corruption, economics, and human rights are high-risk themes today. One professor said to us, since the theme of security is defined within a context of terrorism, those who would seek political solutions are seen as complicit with terrorism. Those who would even critique the coca eradication practices are seen as complicit with the drug traffickers. So you can see that the space in the categorizing of certain topics as taboo or as linked to either drugs or subversion or terrorism, people are becoming more and more limited in what they can speak out about. And I should add an irony, Congressman McGovern cited the irony of U.S. intervention in Iraq being debated in other capitals in the world. I should say that some of the Colombians also mentioned to us a certain irony that the Plan Colombia was never actually debated in the Colombian Congress, although it was somewhat debated within the United States. I will open the mic for questions. If you want to line up on the side and state your name and your affiliation, and you can feel free to direct your question to a particular panelist, to the panel in general, or if you want to just make a comment, feel free to do so. Thank you.
That's the mic. Hi. I'm going to address this to Jim McGovern, because I'm wondering if there's a possibility right now of exploiting two themes, Bush themes. One is the war against terrorism and the AUC being listed as as a terrorist group, because as you've all spoken, there hasn't been any action against the paramilitaries, and this notion that Bush has had of faith-based initiatives. And isn't there a way you can use those two themes of the Bush administration to try and get more of the Plan Colombia funds funneled to groups like at the base that are trying to promote peace, faith-based initiatives in Colombia, and an emphasis on actions against the AUC, of which there's been none?
I'm sorry, could you identify yourself?
Kathy Schneider, American University.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, my goal is to try to get the Congress to even begin a discussion where we could talk about some of these things. And I think, with regard to the paramilitaries, right now in Colombia, there are negotiations going on between the Colombian government and certain elements of the paramilitaries designed to ultimately try to bring them back into back into mainstream society. My concern about that is that we want to make sure that these talks don't guarantee impunity for past crimes. And I think one of the things that I hope the Bush administration will be very strong on is that point, that, you know, that this is not just some kind of, you know, backdoor approach to, you know, providing cover for some of these people who have committed terrible human rights atrocities. We got to your second point. Look, I think that anybody who's been to Colombia can understand the importance of increasing development aid and providing assistance in those areas. When you leave some of the major cities, you go to the countryside, people, some people are, you know, are on the verge of starvation. There's no hope. I mean, there's no infrastructure. I mean, there's a real need, I think, not only for the United States and the international community, but for the Colombian government to be relevant outside of some of these major cities and respond to some of these social needs. So I think if we can get the debate going, you know, we can. We have plenty of topics to discuss, and I think, you know, most reasonable people would I think conclude that clearly there's some major development challenges that we need to be supportive of.
My name is Mary Mullen. Actually, I work at the Bosnia Support Committee, but I wanted to ask about the media. Both the you didn't seem to talk about it, or else I missed it. The domestic media, and also does international media help you at all? And there's one other thing I wanted to ask, Mark, but I forgot. If you answer that, maybe I'll come back to me.
Was it anybody in?
What do you mean? Is it target of violence? Is it effective in any way? And then the other question I do want to ask, too, is about the university-level students in Colombia. Are they forced? I mean, are they free? Are they censored? I mean, what side are they on? Or, I mean, how do they express what they're learning? The professors at the universities, are they censored? I was just curious about that. And the media, I was wondering, does international media, the way they cover Colombia, is that helpful? I mean, domestic media, how can they cover what's happening? And in the countryside, is the media in their, what can these people read? Is the media in their own dialects and so forth?
Let me just say briefly, look, I wish the American media and the international media would focus a little bit more attention on what's happening in Colombia. I mean, there's the you know, there have been some good, there are some good reporters down there who have filed some very good stories. But clearly, you know, with all the events going on around the world, I mean, this seems to be thrust more into the back pages. But I think we're investing a great deal of money in this country. We have American troops down there. Americans have been killed. The situation continues to be a great concern. We're asking. I mean, President Bush is asking. Not only did they sneak $100-something million into the wartime supplemental, but he's asking for another $800 million or most of the military assistance. That's a lot of money, and I think the taxpayers of this country deserve to know what's going on. The other thing is I spoke at the, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the anyway, that's it. It was in the university down there and talked to many of the students and some of the faculty, and we had a very, very frank and candid conversation. There was a lot of fear on some of these college campuses, where people are nervous if they are too candid, if they say what they really believe, that there may be repercussions. So there's that climate down there where I think a lot of people have a lot to say, but they don't feel that they have the security to say it right now. And I think that's troublesome to us. I don't know if anyone else has anything to add here.
My name is Charles Spring, and my wife Carol back there, and I are members of Christian Peacemaker teams, and we've been in the city of Barranca Bermeja the past year ourselves, and our group's been there a couple of years. And some of you may know, and actually want to thank you, Congressman Montgomery, for signing on to the letter that was sent by 21 Congress people to Colombian President Uribe concerning the denial of visas, specifically. Well, peacemakers in general, but specifically to Christian peacemaker teams, an ecumenical group based in the United States and Canada, and we appreciate your support on that. And I just wanted to inquire if, I mean, this is something we've heard, Peace Brigades International is having delays in getting visas, other clergy have been having trouble getting visas. Is this, is there an approach that I guess maybe specifically Congressman McMurrin or others might have in mind of how do we bring this lack of visas for peacemakers, international observers, and to the attention, and try to get more international peacemakers down there.
I think that what we've seen is that every non-governmental organization and every other delegation to Colombia has a different experience on the visa issue. I think in the human rights community here in Washington, we have tried very hard to follow the rules and regulations that have been put in place in recent months by Colombia, at the same time that we think it is inappropriate to have to go through so many hoops, frankly, to be able to visit a country and to be able to travel. The legitimate security concerns need very much to be balanced against the right to information of people within Colombia and of our own population here. What we are encouraging, I think, at this point is a continuing dialogue with the Colombian government. We've continued to raise our concerns about limitations on travel with the U.S. State Department as well, and we will continue to do that. Ideally, I think we would like to go back to not having to go through these kinds of procedures. I don't know if anybody else wants to add to that.
Just, I think that's part of a larger problem. Right now, there's a very significant mess involved with movement of folks internationally getting visas. Congress and McGovern tried to do something about that. Congress, it's a very serious issue, and I think it's compounded when you're talking about activists. That's going to be more. But all of our colleges and universities are having difficulty. If international students or faculty go to a meeting, they may not be able to come back into the country. Or if they go home on vacation, they may not be able to come back. There's all sorts of restrictions on international travel at the present time. We hope that's short-lived, but it's a very significant problem.
Hi, my name is Manuel Roya. I'm with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. And my question is for Congressman McGovern and also for Ms. Stanton. And you mentioned that certain areas face different constraints, like in Barranca you have the migrants and the struggle with the labor unions. And I was wondering if you know what are any particular constraints of the areas in the border with Venezuela, where we have seen the war inflame very dangerously over the past year. And also if the United States foreign policy has any provisions to deal particularly with the issues that the border with Venezuela faces, and if they have any plans to engage the Venezuelan government in working with the Colombians to find solutions in those regions.
I can't speak, I think, to whether the U.S. government currently has plans to engage the Venezuelans. I think we do know that the conflict has escalated significantly in the Catatumbo region and along the border. We actually, when we were planning the trip, thought about trying to go to Catatumbo because it's an area that has very little international presence and very little information is coming out from that area, and ultimately decided that we could not, in the space of time we had, get there and get back without sacrificing other parts of the trip. I think we're very interested in seeing ways in which more information can be obtained in verifying the denuncias, the concerns that have begun to emerge from some NGOs that have a presence up there. We would have the same concerns about how to combat guerrilla groups or paramilitary groups up there that we would have in any other part of the country in terms of what appropriate methods would be and what we would hope the armed forces would do to engage those groups while respecting human rights of the people who live there.
I'm sorry.
I'd just like to add, I noticed also that Mark Schneider is in the back of the International Crisis Group, and they just released a report today, Colombia and its Neighbors, the Tentacles of Instability, and it's available online at their website. You might want to take a look there for more specifics in terms of the impact of Colombia on the region.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, Arauca is the second of the two special zones, and by some estimates, by Amnesty's estimate, is probably the most violent zone in the country right now. And there is a U.S. military presence in Arauca now, very actively involved in training of Colombian military. And there's no question from reports that I've gotten firsthand that this is beginning to have a major spillover effect in terms of Venezuela. For obvious reasons, people fleeing that level of violence are going into Venezuela. And obviously there's the million-dollar question of how much the armed groups use Venezuelan territory as safe haven. So it's a very obvious part in which the U.S. is directly engaged.
My name is Victor Pinzon. I'm president of America's Global Foundation. Congressman McGovern, what is the role, as you see, of us Hispanics here in the United States? We had over 40 million. I am a Colombian originally. I came to this country in 1958. I established this foundation in 1991 in Miami, brought it to Washington in 95. Tried to bring us Hispanics into a critical mass. Following the example of the great Jewish American community. Here, today, Hispanics send over $30 billion to their families in Latin America. Yet, we don't have a significant political presence. We're excluded from the political process. Both political parties are interested in our votes, but you are not addressing us properly. You feel that we are monolithic, and we are not. We are polarized by country of origin. We have 21 different nationalities and many, many divisions. Colombians ourselves are just splintered in so many ways, and that's part of the reason of the Colombian process. Yet, we go to the federal government to try to get assistance and support for us to try to really bring together Hispanics and non-Hispanics into this strategic alliance so that politically we can influence the decisions that you have indicated, your frustration with the rest of your colleagues in Congress. Unless we develop an army of civilians, particularly on NGOs, that we are truly interested in breaking down the barriers that keep people in the wasting resources, human and also economic resources. We are going to continue with this wave of ups and downs and not progressing into the true democracies that we like. So please, I'd like to get your comments on how you see are the Hispanics in this country rallying to support your issues to try to get a solution with your colleagues?
You've asked me a very complicated question, and I'm not sure I could answer you in a short time we have left. Other than to say that, look, I'm interested. I think a lot of us are interested in finding ways, to bring people together and to get people more involved. And I'm happy to. I'm always open to ideas and trying to figure out ways that we could be helpful to get the maximum participation. Clearly on issues like Colombia, it seems to me that one of the challenges we have is to mobilize people, to get people to communicate with their elected officials, to offer their expertise. People who are from Colombia who are now in the United States have an awful lot of insight to offer. I have a large and growing Colombian population in Worcester, Massachusetts, where I'm from. And I meet with members of that community regularly. And again, not everybody in the Colombian community has the same viewpoint. Everybody has very different viewpoints. I'm open to working with you and others to figure out ways that we can achieve both our goals.
We'll take two short questions. Perhaps you could each give your question, then we'll throw it to the panel and we'll close after that.
I'm Ralph Goetz, and I guess I'll speak as a life member of the Florida-Columbia Partners of the Americas. And I have a political comment and a technical comment. First of all, it's a commercial to say that there's another way besides Bola to go to Colombia and do some volunteer work, because our members meet you at the airport and take you home for dinner. I was in three cities of Colombia, four cities a couple of years ago, Barranquilla, Bogota, Ibagué, and Medellin, looking at opportunities for computer training, and I'm pleased to say that some of that is going on, although under other auspices. Now, my question is,
I'd like Mr. McGovern and Ms. Bouvier to consider the hypothesis that I consider the Plan Colombia to be dead. And I think that there is a need for a new plan, like the Constitution of Colombia specifies, for a national plan of economic and social development. The reason I think the plan is dead on the political side in Colombia is that what happens in the change of administration is everything the last president did goes down the drain. And the other thing is that the resources that were pledged in that plan on the part of Colombia are beyond its present means with the problems that it has. Now, on the technical side, I want to know how we can coalesce the technical and advanced professional interests of a highly sophisticated society to produce input to a plan, and then how we can get our State Department that's busily scrubbing the budget for our foreign assistance funds to go to Iraq and other places where turbans are worn, and not in our own backyard.
Okay. And then we'll take the other questions.
Thank you. My name is Haroldo Suarez. I'm a Colombian citizen, but I just retired from international organization here locally in Washington. In the last 3 years, I've been involved with work with two NGOs, one here in Virginia where I reside. I collect money to take to Colombia to provide educational opportunities to poor but meritorious students who want to go to college. Presently, I have 28 students in college. I have another foundation, I am a co-founder of another foundation in Colombia, and we work with displaced and indigenous people. We are utilizing our students to help us in the field, work with displaced people and to children and all that. Those 3 years have afforded me the opportunity to better understand culturally the problem in Colombia. Through my own ancestry, and because I go to Colombia at least twice a year, and through my colleagues who have a lot of experience there. My main colleague in Colombia has got a lot of experience with human rights. She represented the presence of Colombia to accept the first group of guerrilla that were integrated into the Colombian society. As you remarked, a lot of them got killed. Still, there are some that are doing some good work. The question is the following. Because I do not believe that the current framework will give the U.S. a real opportunity to help Colombia. Would you, legislators, consider reframing the parameters or the terms of your aid to Colombia? First, by requiring that the Colombian government, whichever it may be, redefine the real rule of law according to their own cultural understanding, because that has completely changed. Secondly, that you from here better or make the international efforts. And that means the institutions like the UN, UNDP, World Food Program, and all those, more accountable for the work they are doing in Colombia. These institutions have fallen into practices that are not efficient and do not use the international resources as they should. They are not really doing the work as they should. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to just address quickly the last question with a response from the first question that we were given at the Javeriana University from the students was, how can we assure that money that might be sent from the international community is not lining some bureaucrats' pockets? And I thought that was very telling in terms of, you know, the nature of the problem of the international community finding interlocutors that can in fact safeguard the investment of the international community. I'm not going to comment on the obituary for the Plan Colombia, only to say that it would be a mighty grand funeral with the sum of money that's been granted under Plan Colombia. I don't know that you can actually take back money once it's been granted, even if the administration does change. I'm going to pass the last word to Congressman McGovern, and then I'll say a few words of closing.
Well,
Let me just say with regard to Plan Colombia, to me, if you're going to have a plan for any country, it should be developed in that country, and it should be signed off by the people who live there. The people who know Colombia the best are the people who live in Colombia, not, with all due respect, the United States Congress and, you know, the State Department or the Pentagon or the CIA, whoever else is doing this thing. And so I'm all for a Plan Colombia, but I'm not necessarily for this. I'm not for this Plan Colombia. And I think we need to reexamine our entire approach. I try to make that clear in my opening remarks. I do think, you know, we need to focus in on areas that were just mentioned here about how do you establish rule of law. I mean, the issue of impunity is a hugely important issue. Unless you deal with it, a whole bunch of other things that need to happen for there to be a peaceful settlement ultimately to this conflict are not going to happen. And to do that, you need people in charge. You need an attorney general who, you know, administers the law objectively and fairly, and doesn't believe that anybody is above the law. I'm encouraged by the last questioner's comments about trying to provide educational opportunities to Colombians. I'm all for that. I think education is an incredibly important and vital way to kind of help move any country forward. But let me close with one experience we had, because I've been involved in this. I've helped over the years, helped formulate a program along with former Senators George McGovern and Bob Dole called the Global Food for Education Initiative. Basically, you know, to sum it up really quickly, it's to provide every child in the world at least one nutritious meal in a school setting. One of the pilot programs is in Colombia in a community outside of Bogota, one of the poorest communities that we visited. And what we do is we provide the resources so that a meal could be provided in a school setting for these children. And this school was packed with kids, young kids who are going to school mostly because they're going to get a meal, but they're learning to read and they're going to learn to write, and there's going to be a future. All throughout this country, especially in the outskirts of Bogota, I mean, the issue of providing people with just the basic necessities like food, you know, was an issue. And it seems to me, to the extent that we could be supporting those kinds of programs, you know, I mean, giving people skills that can actually translate into something meaningful in the future, providing them a meal. As I said before, I mean, one of the things that the guerrillas and the paramilitaries do is they entice young people into their recruits by providing them a meal and a salary. I mean, we need to start addressing some of these underlying social issues if we're going to get a handle on trying to deal with, you know, kind of the bigger issues of war and peace. And one final thing, because we've talked a little bit about the issue of counter-narcotics and the drug problem. We all need to reexamine our approach to that as well. I mean, as Kim pointed out, I mean, I think I happen to disagree with our policy of fumigation. I think there are other ways to deal with the eradication of coca plants other than through fumigation. But no matter how you deal with it, you're going to have to provide alternative crop development. Otherwise, all you're doing is you're fumigating areas and it's springing up someplace else or in another part of the country or in a different country. And we also need to get realistic enough here in this country to understand that one of the major issues that we need to grapple with is right at home. You want to deal with the issue of drugs in other countries and the growth of drugs in other countries, then we've got to deal with the issue of demand here in the United States. It's not as sexy politically to talk about that as it is to say, you know, let's fumigate coca fields in Colombia or send more Black Hawk helicopters or more planes or more money for the military. But the reality is that if you're going to deal effectively with the issue of illegal drugs in the long term, a lot of that has to begin right here at home.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank WOLA again for sponsoring and organizing the delegation. I'd like to thank a number of people here at the Institute who contributed to the coordination of the event, especially John Brinkley, Quimba Boston, Bert Edwards and the technical crew, Suzanne Whopper and Ellen Edsel, who has updated our web link, a link on the web to various kind of cutting-edge Columbia reports. So that's a place I would steer you for further action. A comment related to the Institute, we do have grants available for various projects that are related to the Institute's mandate. I would refer you to the website. Check and see. Maybe some of these technical support or human rights initiatives or collaborative efforts might have some, there might be some interest here in helping support those kinds of efforts. Thank you again for coming. Bye-bye.